the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am but one of your actual human hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts. Sometimes I don't even think I'm human, but I'm not a good machine. A broken one. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
Beep, boop, beep. I'm Scavarla of Penn State University.
Who apparently is taking on the role of the machine for the show.
I'm the robot for today.
Yeah.
We
welcome you all back to Arthropod. We're very excited to join you today. Second episode of 2024, and we're already, I think, kind of going out and on a limb here, and we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence. Are you guys excited?
Yes.
I don't believe either. Neither of those were very convincing.
I've got thoughts and opinions.
Okay.
I'm not sure excitement is the word that I would use for my feelings about at least generative AI. But we'll get there.
We will get there. Jody, you seemed a bit nervous.
Well, I've been diving into it since we considered this topic. And the more I dive into it, I have a bunch of feelings. But I don't even know how to explain it. I went a really long time without understanding or doing anything about the ChatGPT stuff. Everyone else kind of did it. And then I tried the free version, and it's a little bit blown my mind. And I don't know how I feel about that. And I've thought about a lot of other things that have to do with AI and entomology and how we work, I guess, in extension. And I just have more questions. So I just keep going down the rabbit hole. And that's probably how I feel about that right now.
I think that's probably going to be this whole episode. We'll just as like a preparatory statement for everybody listening, we're going to ask ourselves lots of questions and probably arrive at no conclusions or answers that are satisfactory to any of us. But I do think it's worth talking about the intersection of AI, entomology, and extension. Entomology and extension both are going to intersect with this in different ways. We'll try and parse some of that out. I guess for me, I'm thinking of this more as an extension professional rather than an entomologist. Mike, I'm curious, are you in a different boat? Do you think of it more from an entomological perspective?
I think it depends on which AI tool we are talking about.
Okay. I think that's a fair way to maybe segue into the start of it. So there's probably two ways that we can explore AI, and maybe we can start with the one that's been in the news the most recently, which is generative AI. Do you want to take us through some of the basics as you've kind of come to understand it?
Sure. So, and again, this is my understanding of it. I'm sure somebody that is better versed in all of this may have something different to say. But generative AI generates things based on probability, basically. And those things could be music, it could be text, it could be images. But basically what you do is take one of those things, text, music, images, put it into a learning module. The computer looks at all of those things and then uses those as a base to make predictions. So I think text is the easiest to think about. So a text generative AI, say like ChatGPT, you ask it a question and it spits out an answer. And we can talk about what those answers are. But the way it gets that answer is it looks at the words in your question and then predicts what words should make up an answer to that question based on all of the text that has gone into its learning program. So the one thing that I see a lot with when people are playing with with these generative AIs when they don't really know how they work is that they think that the AI is super smart and knows all of the answers, or that it's searching the internet. Like it's a new search engine that is going out to the internet and bringing all of these things back. ChatGPT in particular hasn't been updated since 2022, I want to say. So they're like, it scraped all of this text information into its learning module and it has not been updated. So it doesn't have new information. It's not going out onto the internet. It is looking at the text that it has and predicting what words should come after each other based on probability. So it is not, it doesn't know anything. It is just predicting strings of text that when we read them as humans, look like information.
We recognize it and we put it into the context, kind of.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like kind of like when you're doing a text and you can do like what it like thinks it's going to say, and you can make these sentences that are super weird, and sometimes they make sense and sometimes they absolutely do not.
That is absolutely what it is doing on a higher level with like better algorithms, but also with a much bigger data set. So imagine like you're phone text is only making predictions based on what you have ever texted. Generative AI like ChatGPT is making those predictions based on all of the words that it has ever scraped from the internet, from books, from wherever, like, you know, a trillion times more information than your phone is using. So because it has more information, it can make better sounding predictions, better sounding to us that sound more logical. But it's still functionally doing the same thing. It is predicting the next word in a sentence based on the previous word in a sentence.
And so that's text-based. There are others such as Midjourney and DALL-E, which are more image-based, where you're talking about a prompt that then the AI will generate some sort of visual example of after you've given it the prompt.
Yes. I wanted to start with text because I think that's easier for people to understand. Because again, like you've seen that on your phone. The image generation is kind of the same thing. It is predicting what pixel should occur next to a pixel based on all of the prompts that are images that have been fed to it. It's part of the reason that generative images have such problems with like fingers when you're doing pictures of humans. And teeth and other repetitive images because it doesn't know when to stop. You get this repeated thing. From a DNA perspective, it's like getting repeats in your DNA and you have trouble like putting them together because they're repetitive. Image generation has the same thing. Like how many teeth does this thing have? Well, I don't know because I'm predicting the next pixel in this image based on the last pixel. And so you just get too many teeth. Or too many fingers. Or things look too smooth. The comic artist that has too many teeth and giant chests.
Oh, Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, that's why everything looks like a Rob Liefeld image. because it's bad at predicting when you get repeats. So it kind of works the same way. It's predicting what things should look like based on what is next to it, based on all of the things that you have fed into it. We can get into the underlying.
Yeah.
Thievery.
Yeah. I think we'll spend a lot of time with generative AI here in this episode. And so I wanted to introduce it here up front, but we'll return to it and really, I think, dive deep into the moral concerns and some of the more soapboxy elements that I can tell you are primed and ready to do.
I am ready.
But let's talk about the other type of artificial intelligence that's often talked about when you're talking about entomology specifically. It seems to be brought up a lot with insect identification. So I will turn again to our resident insect identifier and ask what you know about this and kind of what you've learned about it over the last couple of years.
Okay. So this I actually am something of an expert on. I'm going to be that meme. I'm nice. Something of an expert myself. because I am an active user of AI identifiers. You asked, like, do I put on my entomology hat or my extension hat? I think I would put on my extension hat for generative AI because that's where I've kind of seen it intersect with my job the most. With AI identification, that's where I would put on my entomology hat. And I have much less of a problem with this, and I actually really like the AI identification. So the one people are probably going to be most familiar with is iNaturalist. There's also others. Google has one that I haven't really used. But they all kind of work similar. The algorithms are different, but the basic idea is the same. So with iNaturalist, people are taking photos of plants and insects and animals and birds and whatever. And it all goes into their database. People come along and identify those things. And once an organism is identified to species 100 times, that then goes into their training set. And so the AI, again, is looking at all of these images, and iNaturalist now has something like 49 million, 200 million images on it. It's a gigantic training set that you're training these algorithms. And that's the other thing to say, is all of this AI is just algorithms. It's not smart. It's just a program. But you train it to recognize things in photos based on all of the images that you have fed to it. With, you know, 200 million images, that's a big training set. And the more you feed it, the better it gets. And the more correct identifications based on experts coming along and identifying things, the more accurate those identifications get. And so it is getting more accurate over time as we feed it more correct information.
Is it based on like your location too? Because then they know like the certain species and whatnot from those geographical locations.
Yes.
And then is that why there's like research grade, like it gets bumped up to like a research grade when you're on iNaturalist?
So with iNaturalist in particular, the algorithm can take into account your geographic location and the location of other things that are identified around you. So it won't say identify what you upload and ask it to identify you for you as something from like Africa, when it knows all of those data points are in Africa, but there's this other thing that looks similar that is where you're at. It'll identify it as the thing where you're at. So it does take geography into account. There are some issues with it in terms of how it identifies things. Issues in particular for entomologists, because it struggles with like small drab insects. And other issues that we can talk about when we dive more into it. But as far as like what it is doing, it's kind of similar to generative AI, except it's not generating anything. It's just looking at your image, and all of the images that have been fed into it are things that people want to feed into it, which I think is a big consideration when using it. Personally, you know, I run the insect identification lab here at Penn State. If I get an insect that I don't know what it is, and I don't feel like keying it out, especially if it is showy, something like a colorful caterpillar, one of the first things I'll try is taking a photo, putting it on iNaturalist, and then letting the AI identify it for me. Now, it's not always correct, but I at least have like 3 to 5 things that I can then dive into more and kind of eliminate possibilities. And oftentimes, you know, if it's not the first choice, it's going to be the second or the third choice that they suggest. But it, you know, in terms of a tool, it's actually really helpful, in ways that generative AI maybe isn't, or is at least more morally sound.
Yeah, we'll dig into that more here in a moment. So you've outlined one possible utility there, where you get a mystery bug in the mail or a photograph of one sent to you, and you can run it through this AI and at minimum get a clue, like get a head start on maybe an identification, at least what group it belongs to or something. I know when we were bandying this idea about, you had generated some notes and some ideas about topics. And you mentioned also the identification of soil arthropods and malaise trap insects with this. And I was wondering if you could talk more about what the utility is there, like what exactly would happen.
Sure. So when most people are thinking about AI identification of insects, they're thinking about things like iNaturalist, like Google, There are other applications for this technology where you want something just automatically identified for you. And two projects that I'm familiar with, although I'm not involved in either of them, involve identifying insects that in malaise traps and then soil arthropods. So the malaise trap insect project, I forget exactly what the program is called. Insect Eye. It's actually being run here at Penn State. And so the idea is that you have a camera that you put into a malaise trap head, and instead of the malaise trap catching all of the insects that fly into it and killing them, the insects are forced through a little tunnel where they get photographed by the camera, and then they go back out into the world. So it is not killing any of the insects that it is capturing. It's just taking pictures of them. And then you take those pictures from them that the malaise trap takes, feed them into an iNaturalist-like identification program that you've trained with insects of other images or images of other insects, and then it automatically identifies what the malaise trap is catching for you. It, in theory, it's great because you're not killing things. You have photo vouchers, so you can go back and double check identifications if you need. And it cuts immensely down on the work that goes into processing samples, identifying samples. It just gives you like a list of things that it has collected. And so malaise traps catch a lot of stuff and a lot of diversity of a lot of groups that are hard to identify, things like wasps, micro wasps, and flies. And so there is a, in Sweden, I believe, a giant malaise trapping project. They have something like 80 sites that they've been trapping at for a couple of years. They have many multiple taxonomic experts that are going through these samples and sorting them and people curating the samples. And they are through 1% of what they have collected because it just generates so many specimens. If you're identifying these things by hand, it can be an immense amount of work. But if you can have everything identified for you through photos, then, you know, it can cut down on that work. The soil arthropod project is being, at least the one I'm aware of, there may be more, was being run out of University of Arkansas. And it was a similar thing. So they want to be able to take a Berlaysi sample. So you take leaf litter, drive all the arthropods out with a bright light and heat, collect them into alcohol. They want to take that sample then and pour it out, take a photo of it, and have AI go through and identify all of your mites and other insects in it. And similar, the first thing you got to do is take a lot of photos of a lot of organisms, identify them by an expert, and then use that as your training set so that you can then have the AI identify things for you.
I have also heard of some things that seemingly are more for precision agriculture. What Mike is referring to sounds more like, you know, some good basic research type stuff. I know that in conversations with Rick Besson, my colleague here at UK, he's mentioned a sticky card project and a pheromone trap project where there's a camera outfitted over the top of the either the pheromone trap or the card. And then it will take pictures every so often, and it will send a text message to the farmer, the grower, every morning and say, you know, there's 10 aphids on this, or we got our first fall armyworm today. All these kinds of messages to help you know when to start monitoring for pests or when to begin a certain program at a certain threshold, like when you need to be out and spraying BT or whatever it is that you're trying to use. So it does seem like maybe there's a lot of applications for this if we can get it up and running. But it does sound like an immense amount of upfront work, as Mike was laying out, where experts will be needed to identify and verify all these things.
Yeah, and we'll get to expert ID when we dive into kind of the AI identifiers more, because that is one of the not downsides, but challenges, I suppose.
I think that in the news lately, if people are talking about AI, though, it's definitely been generative AI. I know that's what I've seen most of the articles about, not people talking about using this to identify a plant or a bug, but more this like wholesale generation of content. And I use content in the most derogatory way possible, I believe, in this conversation. I know that I've been really intrigued in the last few months to see some of the controversies that have popped up One of the big ones is an accusation I've seen that's been lobbed against Sports Illustrated, a fairly famous sports periodical here in the United States, where they were accused by a different website called Futurism of not only having articles made by AI, but also having invented authors. So they're accused of basically using AI-generated headshots that they purchased, and then they would assign a fake name to the image, and then they would make up a little bio about the person, about how much they love their dog or working on their farm. And then there were articles that these people, quote-unquote, had written. These have also been accused of being generated by AI. Sports Illustrated is owned by a group that is not a journalism group. They're sort of one of those groups that goes around and buys things and does stuff with them. They're called the Arena Group. I don't want to get sued, so I'm dancing around a lot of words. But the Arena Group have responded to these allegations and basically said it wasn't us. It was this third-party affiliate that we work with. They promised us they didn't use AI at all, but it seems like they did. That's not our fault. And so you can take that with a grain of salt or whatever you want. But they basically said it wasn't us, it was these people. But yes, it does seem, according to Futurism at least, that there were these articles that were a part of the product review portion of Sports Illustrated's website that contained monetized affiliate links as well, so that when you click on them and buy stuff, there's a certain amount that is paid back to Sports Illustrated, and that these were generated possibly by AI, which is startling. And also to find out that there are fake authors sort of populating a page of one of the more prestigious sports journalism periodicals here in this country. I know that I've also seen this with the AV Club, which is a famous movie aficionado website, Gizmodo, which is kind of a technology website. These are all part of what used to be Gawker Media. There's BuzzFeed, CNET, Insider. These have all also either disclosed that they are using AI for certain articles, or they're facing similar accusations that Sports Illustrated is. In the case of Gizmodo, one thing that I thought was interesting, they're owned now by the Geo Media Group that owns them and the AV Club and a couple others. They've been accused of replacing their Spanish translation team with AI. So instead of writing the articles, they're translating them into Spanish using AI rather than paying for that service. So I think this is all eminently fascinating in the most dystopian way possible. It's kind of terrifying. Like, I think people thought of AI as this potential problem solver, and instead we're seeing it be used in extremely capitalistic ways, I would argue.
I was going to say, the capitalists got a hold of it and cut the humans out that they have to pay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but it really does kind of smack of that, where it's like, how can we automate journalism and also make it essentially meaningless and then monetize it? I'm sure we'll get into all of this, but that's journalism. None of us are journalists. We're podcasters, but we are in academia. We do write. I guess, what do you think are the problems that are kind of confronting us as we sort of dive more into this topic?
Well, I know that some of our upper level administrators have been going to courses about using AI in extension. And so I haven't had any reports back, but I did have someone send a potential script that we were supposed to give somewhere. And she was like, oh, I think she was at Penn State. I'm at Penn State in this program and we're learning how to use AI for this, and I ran the script that I gave you through that, and here it is. And it was like, just something to think about. And it was very interesting seeing like what she had told us what to do after she ran it through. And it kind of made me kind of sick, because like I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do things my own way. And I never looked anything up, but knowing that that's something that may be expected of us in the future is a little concerning.
Similarly, I've been in meetings where administrators have said things like, we want to use AI to predict new invasive species in Pennsylvania. how do we do that? Like, they seem to be all rather excited about AI because it's like the next big thing, like blockchain was 2 or 3 years ago. But they don't really understand how it works or what it could do. They just like, it's a new tool that they just want to throw at old problems that, like, if you're writing a script, you just need to be an expert and write the script. Like, they just see it as the new silver bullet for getting more work done with less people, because that means they have to pay less people. And they're all a buzz about it, but they don't really know what it does or how to use it. They just expect us to figure that out.
It is interesting because I guess when I've encountered administrators or fellow academics and this topic has come up, it is either, you know, childlike glee and belief and hope for the use of this as a tool, or complete and total loathing of, you know, it needs to be banned. We need to make sure that we have academic policies in place, and sort of terror, like this is going to completely upend the way that we build courses and educate people. And there's not a lot of middle ground. Maybe we're the middle ground. Jody, you were sharing beforehand, like, your experiences with AI have only appeared in the last week or so. You got too many other things on your plate to worry about what the bots are up to. So, like, what have you been thinking about over the last week? Do you represent the middle ground?
Maybe. We could talk. Like, I've never felt so old because, like, this technology is, like, I love iNaturalist, and there's certain things that I really like. And when I read about how it can help with, like, AI-powered pest management for crops and things like that, because we do want to minimize, you know, pesticide in the environment if it's not needed. And so, like, you have to wait until there's a pest detection, and, you know, there are certain AI that can detect that faster and more accurate than humans or visual or, you know, 24/7. So, like, those things, I'm thinking, like, yeah, that this works. And then there's other things that I see, I'm like, this is terrible. So it's, like, so weird to go back and forth. And, you know, I've had friends and colleagues say, like, oh, yeah, I just needed to reword something. And it's so great to run it through what you want to say and for it to come out in a better way. You should maybe think about that, because it will make your responses seem a little kinder, because I'm very direct. And I was like, what? And so,
wow.
Right. I was like, oh, okay. So, I mean, I haven't really said, like, hey, say this in a nicer way, but, you know, I had tried the, like, reword and then put a sentence in, and it's very interesting. It's just kind of, then you're like, oh, I mean, I have used, you know, synonyms or thesaurus before. And so, like, how far is that off from there? And so it feels like sometimes when you like it, you justify it to yourself. And when you don't like it, you're like, this is cheating. And then I think about the professors, like, you know, you like, how do you know that someone's actually written that? And can you even, like, do you just have to let it go, I guess, sometimes, because that would take forever to find out if your students or your clients or anyone even knows what they're talking about it if they generated that question on their own. I don't know. I didn't even answer your question. Maybe it just shows my confusion. And, I actually started typing things in, like, that people ask me and seeing the answer. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds like something I would say, not the way I would say it, but, like, those are the bullet points. It's hitting the right things. And so, you know, listening to Mike explain, like, how it knows that or what the algorithm is, I'm like, yeah, like, maybe I don't have a job.
I think you absolutely have answered my question to you, because it is a whiplash, right? It's this feeling of, like, I don't want to be anti-progress. Like, I you know, we are a part of Extension. We're a part of the Ivory Tower in some ways, and we have seen the Ivory Tower fight against things like this in the past. Extension was slow, essentially, to embrace the internet, and so we're kind of behind the eight ball on some things just with the internet. And I think that some people are like, oh, well, we can't do that with AI. We need to be ahead of the curve, and we need to embrace this now and figure it out. But I think for the three of us especially, it's like, well, but wait, how and why? Like, can we couch this rather than just say like, oh yeah, no, this is automatically a part of extension. Can we figure out what that means? Or am I just sounding sort of like pedantic about the whole thing?
No, I think that's right on, because, well, and we're kind of doing it here, like all the different types of AI that are out there just get conflated, right? So AI identification gets conflated with generative AI for text and images, and like administrators especially, but even other people that don't really dive into it, like, oh, it's all good or it's all bad. They don't really understand what it is. We just throw it at a problem. And like even trying to take a middle ground, if we just focus on like, say, generative chat, generative text generation, like I think there are places for it in extension. Writing is hard, right? Staring at that blank sheet of paper, or in probably 99% of our cases, the blank Word document on the screen, in generating any kind of text yourself, like it is hard to get those first words on the page. Like once you get going and there's some black there, it gets easier because then you can edit stuff, you can move it around, but just starting can be really difficult for some people. So if you're writing like a new extension document, having text generative text from an AI to like give you an outline, give you something to work with, I could see that being really useful for some people to like get past that mental word block. I think the problem is, like with the Sports Illustrated stuff, when all you do is generate the text and then put it out in the world. Like the big problem with generative AI is that it doesn't know anything. It just generates it based on predictions. And so it just spits out something. And if you're not an expert that is able to double check that information, it could be putting wrong information in there depending on what it is fed from the internet, which contains a lot of bad information. I know people are surprised by that. There's wrong things on the internet. And, you know, getting into more academic sides of things, like it will just make things up because it's not generating information. It's just generating strings of words. So for example, if you ask it to write a paragraph about a specific topic and then include scientific references at the end, it will just make up references based on what it thinks those references should look like. And so there's all these stories of academics getting emails from students or other academics or whatever, like, hey, can I have this paper? I can't find it online. Well, it's not a paper that academic ever wrote. And when you go through, you find out like, oh, they generated the reference based with ChatGPT, and it just made it up. It doesn't exist. It never existed.
But it knew enough to list that person.
Right. And that something topic that sounds plausible.
Right. Because I had a similar experience a little under a year ago at ESA, the North Central Branch meeting, hearing from a different academic that they had asked it. They were curious and they're like, hey, write me a course syllabus for a class that's all about biological control. And it listed a book. It said, you know, oh, and you should have your students buy this textbook. I'm not going to use any of the real names, but it was like by Lee and Smith, Biological Control 2021, Smithsonian Press or whatever. And it was two people that have spent their careers on biological control, two people that have published many papers on it, but they've never worked together on a book. They've never made a book, but it made this book up and it knew the people to put on there to make it look realistic.
Right. And if you're not an expert that can pull those things apart, like, the references is an easy thing to double check because those exist or don't exist. Like that's an easy thing. You can email the author. You can throw it in Google Scholar. Like based on that, we know it is just making stuff up. And so unless you're an expert that deeply knows this subject, if you're asking it to generate text on a specific thing, you don't know if that's true or not. Now, if you're an extension person and you know about this topic, like you could have it generate that text and then double check everything to make sure it's right. Use that as a base to then write your own fact sheet, or, you know, maybe pull even sentences out of that. Although I think that's morally ambiguous to put that off as your own work. But like it is a tool that you could use again to get past that mental block that you can build off of. But you have to be able to know that subject to such a degree to know if these things it's saying are true or not. And the problem is, like, once you get to that level of familiarity with the subject, just write it yourself. You don't need generative text to write the thing at that point.
And I think that's, I don't know, like, we don't want to be political necessarily, but, like, that's where I think some of the crux of this issue is like, you start winnowing down the real people that are actually going to check on this, and you're going to ask them to do more and more with less and less, and you're going to ask them to be experts on so many things. It's just going to get to a point where there is no curation, there is no moderation, or there's not enough to really be responsible. And so you start seeing things just get posted that aren't real. Like, they're just, it's just generated. It's just a prediction of what would have been said by a person that really wrote it. That's like the darkest timeline version of this, I guess. But
so that's already happening. So yeah. to jump from text generation over to image generation, things like Midjourney and DALL-E, if you go on to say DeviantArt, it is swamped with AI generated images at this point. Like, they're, you know, is more AI stuff than human generated stuff. And that's true if you go to, like, it's starting to be true in, like, Google Images and other places. And these AI programs are having a problem where it's a feedback loop where they're just getting new AI generated images. And so they're generating images based on AI generated images. And the quality is starting to fall because, like, they're just looking at their own, it's self-referential at this point. And so the quality falls through the floor because there is no moderation in right. what these things are being fed. So, like, what happens with text generation when the same thing happens? It just gets fed other AI generated text and you don't know, like, there's no checking on it.
Right. And it feeds, I think, some of these, like, darker conspiracy theories about the internet and things. I don't know how either of you are, how much either of you are familiar with the dead internet conspiracy theory that most of the internet is populated solely by bots and made up content that bots have created, and that humans are rare and rare on the internet itself. I know that I've wandered into website. I went to a comic book website not long ago and I walked away, you know, digitally from the experience, almost fully convinced that none of it had been written by a person. Like, all the three or four articles that I clicked through to try and read, they all sort of smacked of AI sort of blankness, of that soulless feel that some of this AI generated text has. And it was just, it was churning stuff out, like, just article after article after article after article. It hadn't seemed to exist for very long as a site, but, like, it had the hundreds, if not thousands, of articles posted. And it just really felt like it was somebody pressing generate and posting and then reaping ad revenue from having that website. And I guess, when I look at it from that perspective, from somebody that is trying to make money off the internet, I can understand the logic behind wanting to do that. Like, I can understand the motivations. But what do you two think of, like, the motivations within the university to do some of this? Like, why have we both, all three of us, had administrators being like, this is it. Like, we got to jump on this train. What is driving them to embrace this so much?
Budget cuts. There's just not enough people to do the work,
and they think that this will help it.
So that's sad.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think about, it's funny because we're supposed to be, like, you know, every interaction matters. We're supposed to be dealing with the people, talking to the people in our communities. We're not those bots of, like, hi, can I help you? Here are the FAQs. And, like, you, now I understand why people are so complimentary, if they are, that, oh, a human called me back, or, wow, it's so, thank you so much for being a human and having a conversation. Because probably when they go to, you know, medical appointments or other services, it's a robot that is at the bottom wanting to give them information that's not from a human. I mean, I went through customer service with, I don't know, airlines and medical appointments. And it's never humans that you talk to anymore. It's very rare. And so it's a little bit sad, like, because I think with our job, it's all about being human, but now they want to take that away in a sense, because they need us to do more things with less people, less money. So.
I mean, I agree. I don't, at least for some administrators, I don't think it's malicious.
Sure.
Like, they are expected to have their employees put out the same amount of, I hate to say content, but like work, but they're getting less money to hire people, get them the resources they need. Like the administrators, at least some of the lower level admin that I interact with regularly, like they know that we're hard up, right? The problem is they see this as a silver bullet to help with that without understanding what it does or how it works. And so they kind of push it because like, look, we can solve this problem because maybe they've gotten a pitch from somebody that is all about these AI products, maybe trying to sell it to the university for a subscription or something. They get this pitch that is all rosy and these people telling them like this can solve your problem if you just buy into it. And so then they push that onto us. And I mean, a lot of people are maybe not aware of what these things are. And so like, yeah, sure, I'll give it a shot or buy into it as well. I don't think it's necessarily, again, malicious, but it is responsive to what is going on in terms of budgets and budget cuts, less money from state governments, because we're all at state-funded schools, and a hard push from certain people in the tech side of things to have AI taken up. Again, the same way that like blockchain was pushed at the beginning of the pandemic, and we see how that panned out. It never really took off because the things they were pushing for blockchain to solve weren't issues that blockchain can or should solve. But it's the shiny new technology, and we'll just throw it at everything and see what sticks.
Yeah, you have sort of said in the past when we have had private conversations about this, that this is the Bored Apes or NFTs of 2023 and 2024.
For sure.
Expound on that a little bit.
I mean, it's just that, like, it's the shiny new technology. There is a lot of hype around it that it can solve all of your problems. But like what it is purporting to do and what it actually does fall short of those promises. But there's so much hype around it that people assume that the hype is real, or that some of it is real at least, and, you know, get excited about it. I had a colleague that wanted to use ChatGPT to write an outline of the history of spotted lanternfly in Pennsylvania. And she thought it would like go out on the internet and search through this information and bring it back to her. And like she could get stuff that's recent. And I sent her a private email because I didn't want to like call her out in front of people in the Zoom call. Like it doesn't do that. And kind of explaining like what we've talked about here today, it just generates text. It doesn't know this stuff. It's not going to go into like private government documents that you can't access online. It doesn't have new information after 2022. But, you know, she had heard a presentation about all the great things that AI can do, and they didn't really ever explain how it works.
Right. A lot of sizzle.
Yeah.
Yeah. To kind of continue the thought line about administrators and embracing this in academia, what do you think they would expect us to do if this were to make its way as part of the interface? We'll talk more here in a second about some things that are actually being built and things that are already out on the internet. But like, what would an extension professional do if you were automating a lot of the calls and questions, maybe not calls, but the questions and the submissions that we get? What are we supposed to be doing if we're not doing that stuff?
I guess babysitting the AI, making sure that it gives the client the correct information.
Okay.
I guess. Like if it's a text-based thing, like they send a text question in via email and then the AI responds, like maybe the AI could generate the response and you just have to read through it and make sure it's correct. But again, like I don't see how that saves us time or effort. So I get the same 150-ish species for 90% of the IDs that come in. And for most of those, I've got an email that I have sent clients before. I find that email, copy paste, change the details. If, you know, one client sent multiple photos and one client sent one photo, I'll change photos to photo. So it looks like this email is custom written for this client. They don't know I've sent it to anybody else. That is going to be faster than me double checking an AI generated response every time it generates a new response. I guess maybe that's where they would see it working, but I don't see it saving time in the long run.
So I was playing around
last night and I was asking some questions and I was just curious. I wanted to see what ChatGPT would say. So, you know, I was asking stuff that I knew about. So it's like, I think I have bed bugs. What should I throw away my mattress? You know, and it goes through and I was like, I wonder what it's going to say, but it said it's not necessary. And then it goes through like steps. And then it's like, well, if it's not a bed bug, what else could it be? And so it goes through like fleas, ticks, mites, mosquitoes, spider bites. I'm like, and it's like instant, right? And then it's like, what if I think there's bugs under my skin? And it said, if you believe there are bugs under your skin, it's crucial to seek medical attention promptly. The sensation of bugs crawling under your skin without any physical evidence may be a symptom of a medical condition known as delusional parasitosis.
Wow.
And then it's like, here are the steps you can take. And then it's like, consult a healthcare professional, undergo medical examination, consider psychological evaluation, and follow professional advice.
That actually sounds pretty good. I wonder how a client would respond to in a bot saying that to them, hey, you might have this psychological condition, versus a human saying that. I actually think there might be more uptake of it.
Yeah, we have been conditioned pop culture wise to sort of trust the computer AI expert from the movies until, you know, they get the bombs and stuff.
So I wonder if that is a place for it, if you can make sure that it is generating the correct answer.
I think I have a slightly more cynical perspective on what they would expect out of us. I think it turns into more of a go get grants. Like, you don't have to do this so you can get us more money. I don't know if that's wrong, I guess, but I do feel like that's part of the end goal is, well, you have to spend so much time talking to all these people. I mean, we've talked on this show multiple times about how long it can take to answer phone calls, how long it can take to write these emails. Mike was just mentioning, you know, he has things in the can to try and save some of that time. I can see where an administrator would be like, wouldn't it be great if we could alleviate this? Like, we're releasing a lot of pressure on you, and now you have so much time to do what? I would assume that part of it is they want you to get money that they can take 51% of.
51%, that's low.
Sorry, yeah.
I think it's like 62 here.
Dang. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, that tracks.
Am I being cynical, Jody?
Probably. That's correct. And like, look at all the money
that they would save. Like, they don't have to pay for headshots. They can just like, you know, take our picture and put us in a professional whatever. Like, there's scary things that could still happen. Like, who knows? Like, I'm always concerned with things on the internet that you don't want out there. You can just make stuff up now. It's not, you didn't even have to be there or be in those positions. It's, you're just in there. Someone could put you in that. AI can generate that for you.
I think that that's an important thing to touch on too, is that, you know, some of this stuff is harmful. I think that, so, you know, we've all been interviewed by multiple media outlets about a bunch of different things. And I worry that someday you'll get to a point where a generative AI will say, it'll predict and generate that it says, you know, Dr. Larson at University of Kentucky said blank, blank, blank about bed bugs, which is possibly something I could have said, but I didn't. And like, it's just making up an interview or it's predicting what it would have gone like. And then you have to deal with the fallout of people finding your name attached to things that either aren't real or aren't factual. Mike, you've mentioned some other abuses that could happen in the past.
Oh, I mean, that seems like a mild abuse. So we already have seen cases where if you feed AI somebody's face and like shots of them with clothing on, you can have it generate fake nude images of them. And then if you leak those onto the internet, like, it's out there and people will believe that that is that person's leaked nude images, and they're not, but like, damage done.
Right.
Like,
how do you undo that?
Right. And, you know, if it's one thing if it's just like nudes, it's another thing if it is something gross or worse, or, you know, I don't want to get unfamily friendly here, but you can imagine, like,
right,
it's not just nude images that you could generate. It's people in compromising positions that they never did.
Right. And you, like, can generate blackmail, essentially.
Right. And it gets out on the internet, and unless that person's got six fingers in that AI generated image, a lot of people are going to believe that. And so it doesn't matter that it's fake. Like, the damage is done.
Right. Reality is belief.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the other thing to say is that this isn't the future. It is now. Like, this is happening. And I think that we in Extension in particular, we have to kind of grapple with this and reckon with what this means for our careers and for our profession next. Extension has been kind of an early adopter of this. If you look at the Extension Foundation, they have had a group. They've had a panel of people since 2019 that have been exploring the use of AI and how to build a chatbot for eExtension, which is called ExtensionBot. I don't know if they take notes on the name, but I might have a few. And it's supposed to answer all the, like, eExtension, we've all been on there, I think, and answered questions before. It's immense. Like, there's hundreds of questions posted a day from all over the country, and you're assigned based on your geographic location or your expertise. You can receive, I've received questions from Africa and all kinds of places on there just because you've listed some sort of expertise that they need. And so they've been trying to figure out a way to make a bot that can help with this and take the load off of extension professionals. We have some links in the show notes about that. We've also heard about individual universities are planning to deploy their own chat bots that are trained on in-house extension documents. I would say that the eExtension one has already received and been trained on thousands of resources from a variety of institutions. Kentucky is on the list. It's one of the lower donors. Nebraska is not on the list. I think Penn State is on the list, if I remember correctly. Did you look at that, Mike?
I haven't.
Let me check real fast. So it's already been trained on documents from a whole bunch of institutions and different numbers. So University of Kentucky is on there. Apparently, we've donated 324 documents, resources that they have fed into the machine. The leaders are Oregon State University, who has donated over 5,200 documents, and Penn State, which has donated almost 5,000. So those are being poured into that machine in order to help sort of populate ExtensionBot's brain with the resources and answers that it needs. It's kind of a compliment, Mike. Like, your stuff is probably in there, probably because it's good. So you're helping to create its frontal lobe.
So I think there's a difference between this, which is being built in-house, like within Extension, based on, you know, vetted Extension material, you know, all the information going into it is good. We have the buy-in from all of the people, or at least their institutions. I didn't approve any of my stuff to go into AI, but presumably my institution did, to use this. Like, this seems okay. Broadly, like, it's not stealing information to be fed into the machine. It's using vetted material. I don't like it necessarily because it does take the human element out of it. People like that. That's the point of extension, is that human connection to get people the answers they need. But I have less, there's less moral ambiguity around this than, say, ChatGPT, where it is just scraping the internet.
Right. I think that you're right on the moral front. I guess I have logistical questions, and that's based on some conversations I've had with other extension professionals who have been in meetings with administrators. There was one, I'm not going to share a lot of the details because I don't know how much of it is public facing already, but one of our administrators was sharing one of these chatbots that's been built by another institution that has been trained on their in-house documents so it can be out front and answer people's questions. And they did a demo and they asked it, how do you grow a tomato? And it provided a laundry list of things of how to grow a tomato. And everybody kind of like oohed and awed and clapped, it sounds like, and was like, oh my goodness, you know, this is great. Like, look at all this information it gave to this client. And my colleague read some of it. And one of the things that they noticed was that it told people to prune off all the flowers in order to increase root production in the tomato plant, which is something you can do. I think it's done in high tunnels and greenhouses, but it didn't then say eventually stop pruning off the flowers so you can actually get a tomato.
So you would prune off maybe the first flush of flowers to get more root production and then let it make fruit.
Right.
But it's not saying that.
Right. The nuance is lost. And I think if somebody is asking a machine how to grow a tomato, they probably don't have that nuance. They maybe don't know that you have to stop pruning off the flowers at some point in order to actually get fruit set, to actually have fruit in the first place. So I think that some of that still terrifies me. And it, like you said, it almost necessitates a full-time extension babysitter to maybe intervene and be like, well, okay, but you need to know this one thing. And then at that point, what has been saved? Like, what have we helped with? Like, if I've got to log in once a month and do my turn as the chatbot sitter, did I really gain anything in this whole process? You both look depressed.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, I guess, personally get through the wave of excitement that is happening now, and it'll die down in a little bit the same way that Bored Apes did. And we'll see what happens on the other side of it.
There are some things that I've read about that seem kind of hopeful and nice. Extension, it has taken root in other nations. And in those places, there are extension agents that face really problematic sort of ratios between them and the growers. And so there are chatbots that are being developed. The ones that I read about were Agra One, Farmer Chat, and Extensio Bot. And that these could be used to try and take some of the load off of them. But I'll post two links in the show notes of articles that are about these. They basically all say the same things that we've been saying. Like, this could help, but it could also require an immense amount of curation. And that might be just as hard as actually answering the questions. But they're hopeful. And so I don't want us to sound like Luddites. I don't want to sound like I'm necessarily afraid that I'll be replaced by a chatbot. I don't think that's my baseline fear. Are you guys afraid of that?
No.
No. So I think we just want to think about this more. I don't know if that's an academic way of looking at it, but
is it kind of like my robot that vacuums, like my iRobot or Roomba? Like, it's really annoying that I have to like watch him like not go off a cliff. It's like, Roomba needs your attention.
Right.
Roomba is stuck on a cliff. Roomba is stuck under my bed. Like, I have to be home to watch my vacuum because I cannot trust it alone. It's supposed to make my life easier, but I basically use my regular vacuum and watch the vacuum at the same time. Like, we vacuum together. It's a helpful tool in some cases, but I really don't trust it, and it still needs a lot of supervision.
Do you feel it does a satisfactory job of vacuuming?
I mean, under beds, like, it's got its uses. It's a tool. You just have to have some boundaries on how you want to use it. And you can't expect that it's better than, I guess, me using my vacuum, I suppose. But it's maybe it's a convenient thing, right? But I don't know. I have a love-hate relationship with the vacuum. So that's maybe why that popped into my head. Because it's supposed to make your life easier, right? And I wonder if that's what people think. But then it's like, you still have to clean it out. You still have to do whatever. Like, it's still going to use work. It's still going to cost money. You need to repair it. You need to maintain it. It's something that you cannot just let go and do its own thing.
I actually think it's a really good analogy, because it is supposed to be something that automates what is perceived by some as an arduous task. But then on the other side of the hype is all the stuff you just listed of, well, actually, you got to maintain it. You got to clean it out. It doesn't take itself out to the trash and dump the contents. Like, there's still a lot of maintenance and care that has to be done. Unfortunately, I think this means we'll never be sponsored by Roomba on the show based just on what you said. Probably lost all those sweet dollars, but I do think it's a good analogy. I don't know. I we're not I don't think we're all like, let's throw the baby out with the bathwater on this. There are possibilities here, but I think we want to be careful about how we embrace it. And maybe it's that we're all just very suspicious of the capitalistic angles to this. Mike, I assume that's one of your soapboxes you were hoping to jump on today.
I mean, it is. I think the last thing to say is we've got to make a distinction with the generative AI, depending on where it's coming from and what's being fed into it. Like with these extension ones, I'm much more okay with it because, again, there's buy-in from at least the administrators of all of the parties involved. When you get things like ChatGPT and especially the DALL-E and the image generating AIs, they're just stealing information and using that to generate stuff. Like all of, you know, the images that go into DALL-E, like there was no permission granted by the people who made those initial images. They just scraped it off the internet and went into the algorithm, and then that's that. And so, you know, you ask it to make me a comic sketch based on Rob Liefeld's, to go back to that,
in his style.
I don't know.
He never gave permission for that.
Right. He never gave permission for that. Right. And yet you can get an image that looks exactly like something he might draw, based on his drawings. Like in, yes, that image is new, but the things that went into it are not. And that to me is just straight up stealing. Like you're putting a thin veneer over theft.
And we've even had some of the people that are in charge of these different ventures basically out and out say that, like, this can't exist without taking all of this stuff that's already online. Like we can't pay you for it. We don't have that kind of money.
We also don't have the capacity to ask everybody for their individual permissions. And right. So we're just not going to.
Right. And so they're pretty much just like, yeah, we took it all. It's all out there. You should have known better than to put it on the internet. And so it's everybody's. And that includes the brain that we're trying to build.
But we're going to make money off of it.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. People are going to have things to say about us.
Do you want to pivot and talk about some of the AI identifying technology?
Yeah, go for it.
Before we wrap up? Because I feel like that's much less problematic. Like, we've already talked about kind of how it works and that everybody is putting in their images and it has permission to use these for its training sets. iNaturalist, I think, is a great tool. I use it. I've written multiple scientific articles based on kind of images going into iNaturalist. It is an amazing tool if you know how to use it. There are some downsides that I think people need to be aware of. Like, it really struggles with insects in particular. Like, you showed a picture of a leaf, of a mammal, of a bird, big showy things that you can get a nice crisp photo of. It's great. But if you've got a small brown bug, it really struggles because, for one, there are just not as many images like that that are properly identified in the training set. And so it can't parse them very well, but also the images often suck. Can I say that? Do we need to bleep it out? The images are not often great. They're grainy. So it really struggles with it.
Which is the same with us when someone sends us like really bad grainy pictures of something smashed, right?
Right. But people expect it's going to be like amazing and spit out the answer that they need. I think the other issue with entomology in particular is just the amount of undescribed species. Like, you can only be an iNaturalist if you have a name, which is good, but there's so many of these groups where there's lots of undescribed diversity. Like, it can't work with that undescribed diversity because it's not named.
I would worry about losing that too, right? Like, losing the chance to identify a new species because you're just sort of relying on, it's not going to come back and be like, I think this is new, right?
No, it just, it'll identify to like the genus or the family level and it just sits there. But also it's not going to do some of the things like pull out the genitalia of small brown beetles that need to be looked at to identify these things.
I think I'm thankful that there's not an internet bot that's going to pull out genitals of anything.
Genitalia bot.
Yeah. Don't say, don't speak it into existence, Jody. I think that's a good note to end on, Mike.
Yeah. But oh, sorry. I really like it for the uses that it can work well for. I think it's a great tool. And like I said, I use it professionally as a tool. Like if you know kind of what, where the pitfalls are, where the blind spots are, but you know, and we have to make the distinction between like the generative AI stuff that we've kind of spent most of this episode on and other AI powered tools, because the other ones maybe aren't problematic, work differently, work better, work in some other capacity.
So we didn't answer any questions. We didn't come to any solutions today. We're not saying don't use it at all. We're not saying forget about it, but we're saying like, let's be cautious. Let's think about the consequences of this. And let's think about the things that maybe have more utility for our science. Did I summarize us fairly well?
Yeah. Know what it does and what you want it to do. It's not, I've said it a couple times, it's not a silver bullet that solves all the problems if you don't know how it works and what it can generate.
And don't write your term paper with it.
Yeah. All those fake references, we're going to find them and know that you used AI and cheated.
Or you'll forget to take out the part where it says as a language model robot and then turn that part in as well. So different flavor of an episode for us. We hope that you enjoyed it. If you have thoughts on AI and the intersection between it and entomology as a science, or if you're an extension and you have some thoughts about AI and it, we hope you'll share them with us. You can do that on Spotify. There's a fan Q&A section on there where people have been leaving some comments. You can also contact us through Twitter. We are arthro_podshow on that platform. You can find us on the web at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. And you can find us all individually on the internet. I'm at Bugman John.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarlo36.
Are you dropping the Napoleonic Into one?
I haven't been on Blue Sky in like a month and a half, but I also deleted Twitter. So I'm at Napoleonic Into on Blue Sky. We'll see if I ever get back on either of those platforms.
You can also email us. That's out there somewhere too. So yeah. We appreciate you all tuning in. We hope you'll come back in a couple of weeks for another exciting episode, and we'll see you there.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on buggin'.